Well, we were in the middle of our little sex talk. We're talking about peenies and testes. And specifically, I left off talking about the cremaster muscle, right? Which is part of what? It's not part of the spermatic cord, actually. It's part of the coverings of the spermatic cord. The spermatic cord itself is the ductus deferens, the lymphatic vessels that surround or that are nearby, the testicular artery, and the pampiniform plexus, which is veins. Okay, those all together make up the actual spermatic cord. But the coverings of the spermatic cord are the two connective tissue fascia layers that sandwiched in between them have the cremaster muscle. And the cremaster muscle helps out in thermostasis, or if you prefer, thermostasis, of the testes to keep them at the right temperature for development of sperm, which is a little bit lower than the core body temperature, right? But they operate when the testes get a little too cool, they operate by contracting to draw the testes up toward the core so that they remain warmer. Like I said last time, that's one of three ways in which the temperature in the testes is controlled. Another is by another muscle, which is called the dartos muscle. And you can see that that is in the wall of the scrotum. The dartos muscle operates, of course, by contraction like any muscle does. But when it does contract, it wrinkles up the covering of the scrotum. The skin wrinkles, the whole thing becomes smaller. And this makes it less easy for conduction heat transfer to occur between the scrotum and the surroundings. And so this will also contract in response to colder than normal testes. All right? So two of those three ways of controlling the temperature come from the action or the inaction of muscles. They'll be relaxed in the opposite situation when it's warmer, hanging the testes lower as possible, farther away from the torso, and also maximizing the amount of heat transfer with the environment by not contracting the dartos. The third mechanism, though, is illustrated in slide 18. And this isn't because of muscular contraction. This is because of what is called countercurrent heat exchange. Countercurrent refers to flow in two different directions, counter meaning against, current meaning flow. So you have two tubes in any given countercurrent system, which occurs not only in living things, but in industry, for instance, or just in invented things. But in any countercurrent system, you have tubes carrying a fluid that is flowing in opposite direction. It could be two different fluids, but they're flowing in opposite directions with respect to each other, but the two tubes are juxtaposed. They're right next to each other. And so we already looked at a countercurrent system in a different organ system. What was that? It was the loop of Henle, or the nephron loop in the kidney. That's also a countercurrent system. It's actually one tube, but it wraps back around on itself, and that's what maintains the medullary interstitial gradient that we were talking about. Here, it's not for the production of a solute gradient. This is to transfer heat, which is why it's called a countercurrent heat exchanger. What we have here in schematic form, it's not really looking like the real anatomy, but a simplified version, is in red the testicular artery, which of course is delivering blood to the testicle or testis, and therefore is coming out of the abdominal pelvic cavity, going down through the inguinal canal to the testis. It is since that blood has not yet reached the testis, that blood is coming from the torso, which is warm. So that blood will be warm. Well, if that blood were sent in a conventional manner, just straight to the testis, then the testes would warm because that blood would be warm. In other words, the blood would deliver heat to the testes. You don't want that to happen because that undoes the whole effect of having the testes hanging out of the torso in this precarious scrotum that I was talking about. So to not have that heat be delivered to the testis, but still deliver the blood, which of course is essential for the testis to live, you have this artery, the testicular artery, right next to the pampiniform plexus, which is just represented here by a single vein for simplicity. But like I showed you, the pampiniform plexus is a large network of veins that surround the testicular artery. Well, the blood coming back from the testis is going to be coming through the pampiniform plexus. All right? And since the testes are hanging out of the torso, they are cooler. Therefore, the blood that's coming back from the testes is cooler. All right? Since the blood in the testes is in the pampiniform plexus is cooler than the blood in the testicular artery, and the two are right up against each other, by conduction, heat is going to be transferred from the warm blood in the artery to the cool blood in the veins. And so the venous blood is being heated before it returns to the trunk, the intent here is not really to heat that venous blood. The intent is to take the heat out of the arterial blood so that it's not delivered to the testes. And therefore, by the time the blood does reach the testis, through the testicular artery, that blood has already been cooled by the venous blood returning from the testis. Does that make sense? All right, so those three mechanisms work together to keep testes at a lower temperature compared to the core and therefore maximize the production of sperm. 9 gives us a closer look at a testis, and the cartoon version in B is useful to see the internal anatomy. Actually, before I get to the internal anatomy, let me just say that the overall testis superficially is lined by a connective tissue coating called the tunica albuginea. Now, what does the alb part of that mean? For instance, an alb is an all-white vestment that a priest wears, but it's also the same root as in albino. Right? Alba means white. So tunica albuginea means white coat. A tunic is a coat. It's kind of like a shell around the entire testis. Now the epididymis is not part of the testis, but it's connected directly to the testis. And you can see it where it's situated, kind of a half moon shape hugging the superior surface of each testis. That's where the bulk of it is. That's where the so-called head of the epididymis is, which is the bulk of the organ. It then wraps around the side, and there's a tail of the epididymis as well, a head, body, and a tail, just like the pancreas, for instance. It then connects to the beginning of the ductus deferens. So the ductus deferens starts at where the epididymis ends, but that is situated anatomically toward the inferior part of the testis. The epididymis, I should say, looks glandular when you look at it. Looks like pancreas tissue or any other gland. Really what it is, though, is a single tube, a very long tube, many meters long, coiled up. So it's very compact, coiled up in connective tissue, and that's what makes it look glandular. The tube, the single tube that is coiled up inside the epididymis has a lumen, of course, like any tube would. It is the tube in which sperm that are created in the testis mature. So the testis does produce sperm in a process called spermatogenesis, which involves meiosis. But those sperm, while they're still in the testis, are incapable of fertilization. They're not yet matured. And it takes a while for them to mature, roughly 3 weeks from the time they're created in the testis to when they can be successful in fertilizing an egg. Well, that 3 weeks is spent in the epididymis. It's such a long tube, even though it's in a small space, that sperm take 3 weeks to get through that big tangle. And by the time that's done, at the very end of the epididymis and the very beginning of the ductus deferens, sperm are stored. Mature, ready-to-go sperm are stored until ejaculation, which is when they're going to quickly go up the ductus deferens, eventually into the urethra, and ejaculated from the penis. That might or might not happen. If it doesn't happen for a while, then the sperm will just degrade and be broken down for raw materials. But they're not ready to go until they make it all the way through the epididymis, about a 3-week journey. All right, if we look inside the testis in the cartoon version, we can see that the overall testis is partially separated into what are called lobules by septa, connective tissue walls, partial walls, inside that are continuous with the kind of shell-like covering but go inward, very much like what we saw in a lymphatic node, a lymph node. Partial walls that are separating the thing into little sections. So these lobules each feature what are called seminiferous tubules. Seminiferous meaning contributing to the semen. Now, semen is a mixture of things. Semen and sperm are not interchangeable terms. Sperm is one component of semen, but there are other things that get added to what we eventually will call the semen along the way. Sperm are the first thing added. And they're added more or less continuously as they're created by meiosis, or spermatogenesis, occurring in the testis, in these seminiferous tubules. So the way that meiosis works is that the new cells that are created, and because meiosis is a cell division process, right? So brand new cells get created. Those immature sperm are created in the lumen of these seminiferous tubules. And eventually they develop and have their own tail and are good swimmers, but they don't swim while they're in the male. They don't swim until after ejaculation. They swim for the purpose of getting up the vagina, through the uterus, through the tubes to find maybe an egg or just die. So it's not because of their tails that they make their way out of the male. They don't use those tails until after ejaculation. Anyway, though, they accumulate, they start accumulating in the seminiferous tubules and get forced along the way, not only because more cells get added, but because fluid gets added, so that they eventually get pushed into what is called this little network still inside the testis called the rete testis. And I think I've used the word rete in other parts of the body already, haven't I, right? Rete means network. And you can see that the tubes from the various seminiferous tubules and the lobules converge into this kind of network appearance. That's the rete testis. Those then, though, empty into what are called efferent ductules that all converge on the epididymis. So the efferent ductules actually are the connection point between the actual testis and the epididymis. But the epididymis, once you're officially in the epididymis, you're no longer in the testis. It's all connected tubes, though. So that's how the sperm produced by the testis get into the epididymis for their 3-week maturation process. And by the time they get to the tail, as I said, they're ready to go, but they stay there until ejaculation. The bottom right micrograph shows you that there are different kinds of cells. This is one seminiferous tubule we're looking at. Different kinds of cells responsible for production of sperm. The cells that actually give rise to sperm, in other words, the cells that enter meiosis and divide in order to produce the gametes, the sperm, are the germ cells. But these germ cells aren't able to function on their own. They need to be nourished by, and they need to deliver waste to, helper cells, which live right next to them, and those are called sustentacular cells. Notice the similarity of that word with sustenance. They provide sustenance. They sustain the germ cells. But the sustentacular cells don't divide to make sperm. They just keep the germ cells alive so that they can divide to make the sperm. And notice that this is all situated toward the lumen of the seminiferous tubules, which is why the new sperm that are created by meiosis from the germ cells are automatically in the lumen of the seminiferous tubules and will be in the lumen throughout this whole network, eventually into the ductus deferens. Outside of the seminiferous tubules, and therefore between the sections of tubules, in the interstices, which are the spaces between, are interstitial cells, which is why they're called that. Okay, we use the word interstitial to refer to extracellular fluid for the same reason. It's between cells, right? It's interstitial. Well, here you have interstitial cells because those cells are between the sections of tubing. So they're not in the lumen of any tube, right? They're on the outside of all the tubing. Those interstitial cells do a completely different job. They produce testosterone, so they are endocrine cells. And this brings up something that's important about the testes, actually both gonads, but testes for now since we're in the male chapter. They are glands, right? They produce secretions. But they are both endocrine and exocrine glands at the same time. What's another example of that that we've already talked about? The pancreas, right. The pancreas produces exocrine secretions that are collectively known as pancreatic juice. But they also produce hormones, endocrine secretions, insulin and glucagon, right? What is it that makes an exocrine secretion exocrine? Right, it's secreted through a duct. Well, the testis, just like the pancreas, is both exocrine and endocrine, but it's even more of a special case compared to the pancreas because the exocrine secretion of the gonads, including the testes, is not only exocrine, the secretion is cells rather than molecules, it's actual cells. The gametes themselves are secreted from the exocrine portion of that gland. In this case, the sperm. But the ovary does the same thing, producing eggs, right? So the exocrine secretion are the gametes. The endocrine secretion is hormones. And those hormones come from the interstitial cells. And that hormone is testosterone. Let's go to 10. Now we can see how this tubing is arranged. And I was talking about this a little bit last time. I said that it's not a direct route for sperm from the testes to the penis, even though the penis is right there next to the scrotum, all basically hanging out of the torso. During ejaculation, the sperm go from the testis through the inguinal canal into the abdominal pelvic cavity, and eventually enter the urethra from within. It's not a straight shot to the penis. All right, so we can see here the epididymis and the tail of the epididymis gives rise to the beginning of the ductus deferens. That ductus deferens then, as part of the spermatic cord, it's a member of the spermatic cord, remember. The vessels, the other vessels aren't shown here, but it goes from the scrotum up through the inguinal canal into the abdominal pelvic cavity, wraps partially around the urinary bladder. So notice it has to come in front of the coccyx bone to, as part of that inguinal canal. Or not coccyx bone, the pubic symphysis, or actually the pubes, the two pubes. The symphysis is right in the middle. Each ductus deferens is right in front of one pubis or the other, left or right. So that's where we are right there. And then it wraps around the urinary bladder and converges with another tube, which is the duct from the seminal vesicle on that side. There are two glands called seminal vesicles, the brownish thing labeled seminal vesicle here. So there's a left and right one. The seminal vesicle is adding its own secretion to the semen as well. And so it has its own duct. The duct of that seminal vesicle converges with the very end, officially the end, of the ductus deferens. All right? The two come together. So the sperm and other and liquid component of semen that came from the testis gets added to the liquid that the seminal vesicle adds because the two tubes converge. And they converge right at the back or posterior surface of the prostate gland. The prostate is the brown thing, which is about the size and shape of a walnut. At least before aging. In a young man, it's about that size, and I think it's bigger usually in men. But you're looking at a cutaway view here. This is a median section that you're looking at. So where the ductus deferens and the seminal vesicle come together, that is the beginning of what's called the ejaculatory duct. Well, you're seeing this in cutaway view. So the two ejaculatory ducts are actually surrounded by the prostate tissue. So they're passageways through the prostate. Okay? Each one of the ejaculatory ducts, which is already carrying materials from two different tubes ahead of it, each one of those then empties into another tube called the prostatic urethra. So the urethra in a male, as I said before when we were talking about the urinary system, I mentioned it then, that the urethra in the male is not only longer in males than females, but it's broken up into three sections. There's the prostatic urethra, which is where the urethra officially begins. Right where the bladder empties, you have the prostate. Prostate and urinary bladder are right next to each other. But running, the prostate surrounds the very beginning of the urethra. That section of urethra that runs through the core of the prostate is called the prostatic urethra. It's just the first part of the overall distance making up the urethra. And that part, of course, is conducting urine, or at least it does during micturition. It's not continuously. The urinary bladder is continuously filling up with urine, but when it's intermittently voided in micturition, that goes through the prostatic urethra first, then the membranous urethra, then the spongy urethra, which goes through the penis. All right, so that's one use of the urethra, to get rid of the urine. But the other job of the urethra is to conduct semen, right? And so these ejaculatory ducts, which are carrying almost complete semen at this point, or somewhat complete semen, are delivering that semen into the prostatic urethra via the ejaculatory ducts. The ejaculatory ducts are also inside the prostate, but they then empty into the one tube in the prostate called the prostatic urethra. And by that time, cells of the prostate, which is also a gland, add their components to the semen. And so now the semen, by the time it's in the prostatic urethra, is almost complete. There's one more thing that needs to add its component, or two things, one pair of things, and those are the bulbourethral glands, the little pine nut-shaped thing right under the prostate in this picture. Those bulbourethral glands will add the final component to semen through their own little duct, which also connects directly to the urethra. But at this point, it's just outside of the prostate. And so you're no longer in the prostatic urethra at this point. You're in the shortest part of the urethra, which is just the part that penetrates that floor of the pelvic, of the abdominal pelvic cavity. And that's why that part is therefore called the membranous urethra, because it's going through that membranous floor of the abdominal pelvic cavity. But that's right where the bulbourethral glands secrete mucus into the mix. All right, so that's by far the shortest part, just that little section going through the red membrane, the muscular floor. Once you're out of that, you're in the final part of the urethra, which is the spongy urethra, and that gets its name because the penis is made up of three columns. And one of those is called the corpus spongiosum. All right, and you can see that centrally placed column right here. The corpus spongiosum gets its name because it has a spongy appearance in dissection. And notice that the corpus means body. So it means spongy body. But the proximal part of the corpus spongiosum is the bulb, because it's in bulbous and enlargement where it starts. And that's the beginning of the spongy urethra. This is the membranous urethra right here. This is the prostatic urethra. And by the way, it's prostate, not prostrate. Anyway, after the bulb of the corpus spongiosum, it doesn't keep converging. It straightens out through the shaft of the penis, but also notice it forms the glands or the head of the penis. And through that entire length of corpus spongiosum, you find the spongy urethra, so named for that reason. So the corpus spongiosum has been dissected here, but it completely surrounds the urethra. So it's a tube running through the middle. That's just one of three columns, though. The other two columns are twins of each other, so there's a left and right version of them. There's only one corpus spongiosum, but there are two corpora cavernosa, the singular of which is corpus cavernosum. Corpora is just the plural of corpus, means bodies. And cavernosum comes from the fact that it's broken into little subsections, little caverns. And notice that they do not feature, they're not connected to the urethra at all. They surround on either side, I shouldn't say surround. If you looked at the penis on end, you would see the three columns in triangular form. Two corpora cavernosa and one corpus spongiosum in the middle, with the urethra through it. Well, those are important in erection. They are erectile tissue because they get engorged with blood and cause the erection. We'll talk more about that later, but that's how the urethra is arranged. And so you can see the overall route in the bottom picture here that semen or its components have to take during ejaculation. The components of the semen added by the testes and maturing in the epididymis leave that epididymis, travel up into the abdominal pelvic cavity, wrap around the ureter, join with the seminiferous tubule, the seminal vesicles duct to form the ejaculatory duct on either side. That gets you into the prostate. The prostate adds its part of the mix into this prostatic urethra, and then after it leaves the prostate, it's in the membranous urethra, where the final bit gets added by the bulbo urethral glands, and then out of the penis through the spongy urethra. I think that's all I wanted to say about that one. Eleven shows you that end-on view I was just describing. Well, part B does. So notice that you have the triangular relationship. Two corpora cavernosa, one corpus spongiosum through which the spongy urethra travels. I think I already told you that another name for the foreskin is the prepuce. And so that is the glands is part of the spongy corpus spongiosum. The prepuce is the skin that covers the glands. Now if we look at the part B, the cutaway view of these erectile bodies, notice that there are major veins running dorsally along the penis shaft. And dorsal means toward the back, in general, right? This is the dorsal surface, this is the ventral surface. There's a ventral and a dorsal surface to the penis as well. But they only make sense in terms of front and back if you imagine an erect penis. If it's not erect, then what we call the dorsum of the penis is actually facing frontward. But if it's erect, then the dorsal part of the penis is actually the back surface. That's how you need to think of that. And so that's where you find these veins, this main dorsal vein, but also other smaller veins in that same area. And those veins, of course, are carrying blood back from the penis to the, eventually to the inferior vena cava, right? Carrying back blood back to the torso. Well, arteries that are in these corpora cavernosa, these erectile tissues, bring blood to those corpora cavernosa. And when that happens, if there's vasodilation occurring that opens up the flow of blood to these arteries that serve the corpora cavernosa, all of a sudden there's a lot more blood than there usually is. Usually there's just enough blood to keep the cells alive coming in. But when there's a rush of blood, because upstream there's vasodilation, this blood engorges the corpora cavernosa and also the corpus spongiosum. And this is what causes an erection. Well, I mean, that's what brings the blood in. What actually keeps there wouldn't be an erection just because there's an increase in incoming blood if the outgoing blood also increased, right? It would just mean that you're running a lot more blood through the penis, but there wouldn't be any more blood in it at any given moment if what was coming out equaled what was coming in. But because of the arrangement of these erectile tissues, when they do get engorged with blood because the more blood is suddenly coming in, that pushes on the veins and compresses them shut. So now you have blood coming in, but not nearly as much coming out. And that is what causes the erection. It's just a hydrostatic pressure buildup because of the increased amount of blood. Anything else I wanted to talk about here? No, I don't think so. Well, we can go to 12 then. And we've seen these kind of feedback diagrams before, specifically in the endocrine system. Well, the testes are part of the endocrine system, remember. They're not only part of the reproductive system, they're part of the endocrine system as well. They are endocrine organs. So hopefully this will be some review for you. If we look at number one, it's labeled as GnRH. What does that refer to? Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, which, remember, is not a gonadotropin, right? A gonadotropin is something that acts on the gonads. GnRH does not affect the gonads. The gonads don't have any receptors for GnRH. So even if GnRH reaches the gonads, they don't know it's there. Doesn't work. So gonadotropin-releasing hormone is so named, remember, because its effect is to release gonadotropins from somewhere else. Well, where is GnRH released from? The hypothalamus, which is part of the brain, right? So it's a hypothalamic-releasing hormone, specifically releasing gonadotropins. The gonadotropins themselves are released from where? Anterior pituitary, otherwise known as what? Adenohypophysis. Good. So the gonadotropins, there are two major gonadotropins, and what are they? Follicle stimulating hormone and what? Luteinizing hormone. Now these names, both of them, follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, are named for what they do in a female. But they're the same exact chemical in a male. And for simplicity, most people use the same name in both males and females, although other names have been devised for the same chemical in a male. It's easier just to use the female names for both, so you don't have to memorize even more terminology. But we haven't studied the female yet. Let me just tell you that the luteinizing hormone gets its name because it produces what is called the corpus luteum in an ovary. Well, it doesn't do that in a male, obviously, right? Because there is no ovary in a male. The follicle stimulating hormone gets its name because it stimulates a follicle, which is a cell in a, or it's a structure in an ovary, into making a mature egg so that it can be ovulated. Well, it obviously also doesn't do that in a male. They just get their name because they're the same chemical. But follicle stimulating hormone in a female produces an egg, which is a gamete, right? Or, I mean, it helps out in the production of an egg. So that part is shared in a male. The follicle stimulating hormone in a male leads to the production of sperm. In other words, it helps out in the process of spermatogenesis. So in response to gonadotropin-releasing hormone, one chemical from the brain, specifically the hypothalamus, cells within the adenohypophysis, or anterior pituitary, receive this signal, this hormone signal. And by the way, how does it get there? How does it get to the adenohypophysis? Via which portal system? Right, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system carries that released hormone from the hypothalamus, GnRH, the short distance down the stalk, down the infundibulum, through this portal system, to a certain population of the cells making up the adenohypophysis, which are responsible for producing the actual gonadotropins. You remember what those cells are called? Yes, gonadotropes. Gonadotropes. So the gonadotropes are the cells, the specific cells within the adenohypophysis that have the correct receptor types to bind to the gonadotropin-releasing hormone coming from the hypothalamus. In response to that, they release both FSH and LH, luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone. Well, the follicle-stimulating hormone, which is the inner green line, acts on sustentacular cells. Not the cells that become sperm, but the cells that help the germ cells to become sperm by undergoing meiosis. All right? Well, the sustentacular cells respond to this follicle-stimulating hormone by producing something called ABP, which is androgen-binding protein. Now, what is an androgen? It is a hormone, but specifically what kind of hormone? What does andro mean? Male. Yeah, so a masculizing hormone is an androgen. And what is the chief androgen? Testosterone. So ABP, which is produced by sustentacular cells in response to follicle-stimulating hormone, allows testosterone to accumulate, which will be important in spermatogenesis. What we're looking at here is how things happen during puberty, which is the beginning of adolescence. Okay? Before this time, this stuff doesn't do anything. It's not kicked into gear yet. But anyway, the testosterone accumulates because it binds to the androgen binding protein that's released by sustentacular cells. So that eventually leads to or promotes spermatogenesis, production of new sperm, which is why it goes along with what happens in the female. It's producing gametes in response to FSH. At the same time, though, the gonadotropes from the adenohypophysis release luteinizing hormone, which, of course, don't operate the same in a male. They don't produce a corpus luteum, but they operate on interstitial cells. And interstitial cells, remember, the ones that are outside of the tubing in the testis, are the ones that produce testosterone. So luteinizing hormone promotes release of testosterone from endocrine cells called interstitial cells in the testes. The testosterone itself, some of that is going to be accumulated because of the ABP that was just produced by the sustentacular cells in response to the other gonadotropin. But testosterone, although it is important for spermatogenesis, is important for a whole bunch of other reasons during puberty, which is why the green line continues to the right. So testosterone leads to development of secondary sex characteristics, the ones that I talked about earlier, like a sudden increase in muscle mass in a male. That's in response to testosterone. It becomes more muscular. Metabolism increases, mostly because of the increased muscle. Voice deepens. The voice box gets more prominent in the neck. The shoulders become broader. Pubic and axillary hair grow, and eventually beard hair, facial hair. Those are secondary sex characteristics, but the secondary sex organs also are affected by the testosterone, so they grow as well. Scrotum and penis get bigger. And another branch of this up at the top is that testosterone wakens the libido, or the sex drive, in the brain. Now, those are all stimulatory effects, which is why a green line was used for all of those. Notice that sustentacular cells also create and release what is called inhibin. Inhibin is itself a hormone. But inhibin is called this because it's part of a negative feedback mechanism and it inhibits something. Well, what does it inhibit? It inhibits the pituitary release of follicle-stimulating hormone without affecting the release of luteinizing hormone. So this is a way for a signal from the hypothalamus in the form of gonadotropin-releasing hormone to end up causing the release of just luteinizing hormone without also releasing follicle-stimulating hormone. At first, they're both released, but once the sustentacular cells are stimulated enough by the follicle-stimulating hormone, they produce enough inhibin to shut down further production of follicle-stimulating hormone. Okay, does that make sense? So, in other words, once you have enough sperm for the moment, you can shut that part down without shutting down the luteinizing hormone, which would have the effect of shutting down testosterone production, which you need more or less continuously. But this is, like I said, this is especially during puberty that this is happening. Eventually, the inhibin negative feedback mechanism kind of disappears in later maturity. The testosterone itself, though, has a negative feedback aspect to it as well. It feeds back to both of the two first steps, feeds back to the hypothalamus, and therefore decreases further production of gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and it also directly feeds back to the adenohypophysis itself, which will decrease production of FSH and LH. 13. Now we can take a look at meiosis. And in males, it's a lot simpler. In males, meiosis is just like you learn it if you've learned it in any other course. Has everyone had meiosis before? Okay. Well, meiosis is fundamentally different from mitosis, but both meiosis and mitosis share something. What do they have in common? Right, but what gets divided? The nucleus. Mitosis is not cell division. It's part of cell division. Mitosis and meiosis both refer to division of the nucleus, which is just part of the cell. Division of the stuff that's outside of the nucleus, which is the cytoplasm, is cytokinesis. Only if you have both things happen do you actually have brand new cells. Okay? And I say that because there are special cases where a cell will undergo one or more rounds of mitosis without undergoing cytokinesis, and what you have then is one cell with multiple nuclei. But that's the difference. That's between the two major processes of cell division. Mitosis and meiosis have differences, though, even though they're both divisions of the nucleus. The big difference, well, there are several differences between meiosis and mitosis, is that meiosis features two rounds of division, whereas mitosis features only one. Meiosis has two divisions, and therefore you end up making four things. If you split twice, you split once into two, and then each of those splits into two, so you make four things. Well, those things, actually we call it only meiosis, but cytokinesis is happening as well. And therefore, meiosis along with cytokinesis ends up producing four distinct cells. And those cells are the gametes. Whether it's a female or a male, meiosis is occurring in both. And so that's how gametes are produced. But in males, remember, the gametes, the sperm, really just need to be sleek swimming machines that are just little more than a bunch of mitochondria for the swimming, the tail itself, and then the DNA that's going to be delivered to the egg. That DNA is really the only part being contributed to the zygote by the sperm. And so it's good to be small if you're a sperm. Easier to swim farther. So in male meiosis, all four of the cells that are produced from one cell originally that enters meiosis are viable gametes. They're all equally able to survive. Now, they're genetically distinct from each other. Each sperm is different from every other sperm in the same individual, genetically. But they all are equally good swimmers. They're all just as likely as any other to fertilize an ovum or an egg if it encounters one. As we'll see when we compare meiosis in the female chapter, it's not true that all four are viable. It's true that four cells are made in a female, but three of them will just be wasted, and they're made as small as possible, saving as much as possible of the original cytoplasm for the one that's going to be chosen as the egg. So it can be as big as possible and therefore survive best once and become the zygote once fertilization, if it does happen, happens. I guess I'm out of time now, so we'll talk more about the particulars of the meiosis next time.